WDIY 88.1 FM. You can also find us on WDIY.org for more Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Rhea Malhotra, your host this evening, and doing our audio engineering is Seamus McGrogan. This is the second edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse's new monthly segment, The Teen Scientist, where we bring you groundbreaking innovation in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics disciplines entirely from a teenage perspective. We also highlight excellence in high school independent research and technological development. I myself am a junior from Moravian Academy, your host today, and in fact with me on air, I have a special guest, Nehali Gupta, a senior from Parkland High School in Allentown. Hi Nehali, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Rhea. How are you?
I'm good. So for our listeners, could you tell us how old you are and how long you've been participating in science research?
Sure. I'm currently 17 years old, and I've been participating in science research since a seventh grader. So it's been about 6 years or so.
We're so glad to have you with us today. After talking to Nehali about her own research in the biological sciences and engineering, specifically regarding diabetes testing, we will also discuss the existing state of healthcare and diagnostics for diabetes as it pertains to her study. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Okay, so just to start off, can you tell me a little bit about your project in general and the study you've worked on in the past years?
Mm-hmm. So I worked on making an innovation that was looking towards creating alternative forms of testing for monitoring symptoms or conditions that also develop with diabetes. So specifically, what I was looking at was the presence of ketones that also develop when one has diabetes. What I specifically looked at for alternatives were looking at the presence of ketones in sweat, which are usually detected in blood and urine.
So what are ketones?
So ketones are basically molecules that are representative of when the body's blood sugar levels are far too high. And as a result, the body's out of equilibrium in how it's managing its glucose and fat levels.
Interesting. So how does your test utilize this mechanism to detect diabetes?
Mm-hmm. So more specifically, detecting diabetes, the patch itself, as I'll refer to it, the patch itself is there to detect the amount of, in a way, disequilibrium of the body's management of glucose levels, which can be dangerous for many people with diabetes because the mismanagement of glucose can result to other symptoms in the body, such as a buildup of more harmful toxins in the blood, and which lowers the blood's pH, which is really bad for the homeostasis of the body. And this also causes adverse effects on your organ systems as well, which we need that optimal pH to function.
So why is diabetes such a pressing issue today?
Well, to name some stats off the top of my head, I know it is the seventh leading cause of death worldwide. And furthermore, diabetes is a pressing issue more now than ever before, specifically because it focuses more on self-management, which is very difficult to incorporate into the lifestyle of many who have been diagnosed with it. So the reason it's such a pressing issue is because many people are still unaware how to manage it properly and how to basically live with diabetes.
So are you saying that today's lifestyle is inducing more diabetes and increasing the effect of this condition more than it has in the past?
Definitely correct.
Interesting. So talking about today, what are the existing methods utilized in order to diagnose this condition?
So currently, diabetes is usually diagnosed. Many people actually have to do blood work to stay on top of the fact of, stay on top of how their body's conditions are, and especially as you get older, they require you to do the testing to test if you are pre-diabetic or already have diabetes. For some people, it may even come at a much younger age in the form of type 1 diabetes, which really can't be prevented in any way or form. So the existing methods that would be used to diagnose this condition would be simply at a hospital. That there's no real way to detect it any other way.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lack of diagnostics in diabetes? What are the current issues with the system?
So at the moment, it's not as much as an issue of diagnosing diabetes, but the real issue lies in incorporating the management needed to maintain diabetes, to control someone's diabetes at a healthy level. The management methods of diabetes are what the real issues are for patients who have diabetes in today's society.
So the insufficiency lies in the lifestyle of patients?
Mm-hmm. The insufficiency lies in how people are incorporating the necessary diet, the necessary exercise, the necessary monitoring needed with diabetes.
So your test is sweat-based, correct?
Correct.
So just to give us a visual description, you would say, how big is it?
If you put your fingers together. I'd say about 4 inches across 2 inches.
It's a patch that you can apply to your skin, correct? So Nihaly's test is based on sweat and ketones detected in your sweat.
Correct.
So currently there are more of 10 general classes of tests available commercially for diabetes diagnostics. What makes yours unique?
What makes mine unique is the fact that it uses sweat. Sweat isn't the, I'd say, body fluid of choice when it comes to diagnostics and diabetes. However, many people are really familiar with the blood and the urine alternatives, urine test strips and blood meters, especially for detecting ketones. However, especially for younger children and for people who have just been diagnosed with diabetes, it's difficult to immediately transition into these forms of testing. And that's why the sweat-based testing for ketones is especially helpful for these kinds of demographics.
So just to get a sense of the state of diabetes today, in 2015, 30.3 million Americans, or 9.4% of the population, had diabetes, according to the American Diabetes Association. Of these 30.3 million adults with diabetes, 23.1 were diagnosed, while 7.2 million were undiagnosed. 1.5 million Americans are diagnosed with diabetes every year, and as you said, it remains the seventh leading cause of death in the United States. So how does your study help manage the vast pressure diabetes poses on healthcare today?
So specifically, the test that I've created, it's referred to as the keto patch. The keto patch is especially helpful in helping people transition into a life that was perhaps not focused on managing their diabetes into one that must be. For many people, this happens at the point at which they're diagnosed with diabetes. For others, it happens when they've had serious complications and realize that monitoring their ketone levels is something that must be done much more regularly, usually as told by a physician. So it really helps manage this fast pressure by giving diabetes patients a much more convenient alternative with which they can incorporate into their lifestyle and say it's not as hard as it is with other, I'd say, methods of diagnostics.
So does your keto patch, is that an alternative to like pricking and blood testing on a daily basis? So can your test help increase the availability to reduce the number of diabetics that go undiagnosed?
Definitely. So in diabetes, there are actually many complications that also arise out of simply having diabetes. Diabetes refers to the misuse or like the
mismanagement of blood glucose.
Yeah, mismanagement of blood glucose. And the fact that this is just a small part of what's happening in the body, and this has a very, very large effect on the organ systems throughout the body. So this test, this keto patch, helps diagnose the other complications that can arise from the mismanagement of basically diabetes. A very severe one could be as kidney failure, or something much more simple would perhaps be hyper or hypoglycemia.
Interesting. So can you just tell me a little bit more about the process by which you made the test itself?
Mm-hmm.
What went into the method of constructing it?
Sure. So what went into making the keto patch? Well, it always starts in the classroom. And I think I was a sophomore when I was in a biomedical sciences classroom, and we were doing our unit on diabetes at the time. So I would definitely say that was a class that was really helpful in giving me the inspiration to really do more research into something that interested me. And at the moment, that was diabetes. When I got into doing my research, more focused on the classroom, and then later out of my own curiosity as to like how what I was researching, how it was done in more detail, how it was how could be applied to more real-life methods, that's where I got into the idea that alternatives can be made to what exists already, even though such a huge population of the world is pre-diabetic, has diabetes, or has been suffering from diabetes for such a long period of time, there are not that many tests that we can see available. One would expect that there would be many, many more diagnostic methods available to help this large population, but there are, in fact, not.
So can you tell me a little bit more about how you actually constructed it? So what gave you the idea of a patch instead of the traditional, more injection-based methods?
Mm-hmm. So what I was looking for was a way to basically create an alternative test that would not be as invasive per se, or much more easier to use, and much less along the lines of, you know, pricking your finger or like having to do a urine test strip. I was looking for a way that would be perhaps much more easier to use, especially on the go, like perhaps saliva or perhaps even what I came across was sweat.
So more convenient for the patient or the consumer.
Exactly.
So it's easier to be incorporated into someone's lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So did you initially start with a patch? Was that your initial idea, or did you go through a few phases of ideas that didn't necessarily work?
So I definitely did go through a few phases, because what I knew when I began my research was, you know, the basic chemistry of how there are biomolecules in the sweat or other body fluids that can be detected using specific indicators. And what I was looking for was, most of my brainstorming really came about in how am I supposed to incorporate this indicator into a device that will be able to measure these biomolecules. So after doing especially a lot of research on current innovations as well, I came across the idea that there are test strips, but those test strips also already exist. And even though they would be also a non-invasive method of testing, they still pose some of their own inconveniences. So I was looking along the lines of a test strip, and it came across the idea of basically a patch. And when I finished designing my innovation, that's what it resembled most.
Interesting. So what is the actual component form of the test strip? So what mechanism is the test strip detecting the ketones?
All right. So the mechanism is actually one that mimics what already exists in the urine test strip. So it's a chemical reaction, basically, in much more simple terms. It's a chemical reaction between ketones and sodium nitroprusside, which is the main reagent present in urine test strips. So that reagent is, again, incorporated into the patch. However, since the patch is also on your skin, there are other components that you would say that have to be incorporated into the patch to maintain the proper pH, the proper concentration levels, and also to make sure that everything in the patch isn't coming in contact with the skin.
Interesting. So you're using an existing testing method, but kind of reworking the structure and use of that test for sweat-based diagnostics.
Exactly.
Interesting. So is there a trade-off between the concentration of the ketone molecules that are being detected and the sensitivity of the test? So is it able to detect higher ketone levels or the degree of hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia?
So what happens with, I'll go with urine test strips first. Urine test strips are, when they detect the ketone molecules, they show a color reading, right? And that color reading can be compared to what is shown on the box of the ketone test strip.
So the level of blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
So
or not blood glucose, ketone.
Ketones.
Yeah.
So using this color test, you can identify the concentration of ketones in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Or that one's for the urine test strip. So after that, then we have our sweat-based keto patch. And the keto patch also uses the same chemical formula, same reagent. So it does also have that color change. However, because in sweat, the ketone molecules are in a much lower concentration. That's why a better way to put it is, yes, sensitivity is slightly compromised. However, another reason that the sweat-based is actually a bit more accurate than the urine test strips is because in the urine, there are also components called sulfahydrols. Those come from many foods that you can eat, like pineapples or eggs, or I think asparagus is one of them too.
Asparagus?
Yes, asparagus. Asparagus. So yes, asparagus. There are many common foods that are high in sulfahydrols, and those are also present, those sulfahydryl groups, which are functional groups, are also, after being processed in your digestive system, also show up in your urine. And those also produce a false positives on your ketone test strip in the urine. So that's why the sweat-based alternative is a bit better in that it doesn't pick up those sulfahydryls.
So it has a better margin of error.
Correct.
That's remarkable. So we're actually going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue discussing the viability of novel diabetes diagnostics with Nehali Gupta, our featured scientist from Parkland High School. This is The Teen Scientist, and I'm Ria Malhotra on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We will be back shortly.
The many choices and real voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Teen Scientist on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Ria Malhotra once again, and I'm here with a senior from Parkland High School, Nehali Gupta. Nehali has been telling us about her incredible research developing a sweat-based testing method for diabetes mellitus, a condition affecting millions worldwide. So Before we were actually talking about how her test works. So you've developed a patch that is able to detect ketones through sweat.
That's correct.
And using this, you can actually detect hyperglycemia.
More specifically, it detects, hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia are conditions that are detected through the non-equilibrium of ketones. And yes, that's exactly what the keto patch does.
So how have you been testing this so far? Have you tested this on humans or any species, or has this all been kind of in vitro?
It's currently been in vitro testing, especially because with the idea of an innovation, it's hard to begin with an innovation on a
sample. Yeah,
exactly, because you don't know where you would mess up first, and that's why it's still in its primary stages at the moment.
So in your experimentation, have you been testing the patch on a sweat-like sample, or what has been the actual experimentation through your study?
So sweat samples, again, are... It's hard to get sweat samples from specific concentrations from people who have diabetes. Therefore, what I've been working with is basically fluids that resemble sweat in many other chemical properties, and I have added concentrations of the biomarkers, the ketone molecules, at different concentrations in these fluids. So that helps basically provide a control point or vantage points for as to how sensitive this keto patch is. So yes, at the moment, it's like artificial fluids.
Interesting. So sweat is formed from many different chemicals. So do these peripheral reactions affect the sensitivity of your ketone test?
I know exactly what you're referring to because this was an issue for me when I was doing my research too. I was looking for for ways in which I could, mimic these other chemicals in the sweat as well. But the biggest thing I came across in my research for finding sweat alternatives was the fact that sweat is mostly water, and the greatest concentrations of other chemicals are usually sodium ions and more basic trace elements that are also present in the blood. So these chemicals and these ions that are also present in the sweat, the secreted sweat, these actually don't have much of an effect with the reagent that's already present, because it's, in better words,
it's a low concentration, so that it doesn't react as much?
Exactly. Okay. The reagent itself is at a very high concentration, and the ketone molecule, it's only specific to the ketone molecules that are being secreted in the sweat. So it can't be really triggered by the other very low concentrations of trace elements.
So if you're looking for reaction A, then reaction B, C, and D, and all these other molecules that are present in sweat don't really affect your test.
Exactly.
Okay. So from a broader sense, I know that this test is specifically designed for diabetes testing, but do you think that this testing method using sweat can be applied for other conditions?
Most definitely. In fact, actually, one of my ideas for further testing included methamphetamines, because sodium nitroprusside, this reagent, is also something that is a reagent that reacts with many recreational drugs, which include methamphetamines. So yes, this is a testing method that can be applied further with other molecules that may want to be detected in the sweat.
Interesting. So would it be hard to transition the medical industry from traditional testing to your enhanced version?
I wouldn't say it would be a difficult transition. However, this the alternative form of testing, this keto patch, would be more, I'd say, preferred by the demographics of people who are testing individually. So as to give an example, a diabetes patient would have the regular checkup like once or twice a year, right? So at that point, their physician would let them know that, hey, your ketone levels or your other levels need to be monitored regularly. And as a result, you should probably look into other forms or look into alternatives in which you are able to better manage your monitoring of these levels. So that's the case in which somebody would say, okay, I'd rather not invest in a glucose meter, or in a blood meter, my mistake, in a blood meter, because one, those are really expensive, and two, I'm a bit squeamish about that. That's the case in which somebody would adopt the use of a keto patch.
So this is essentially to enhance patient comfort.
Exactly.
With the condition.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that doctors would recommend this to patients, or a patient would go out of their way?
I'd hope so. I hope a doctor would recommend this, because it definitely does work the same way as other acceptable, I'd say, diagnostics in the field. And I guess after this goes through all the proper stages of testing, hopefully it would be acceptable by the medical professional community as well.
So what incentive is there to use your test specifically? Because if people are squeamish about blood, they wouldn't necessarily want a blood meter, but the mm-hmm. urine test is available. So mm-hmm. what makes your test specifically the easiest?
So what makes my test the easiest? One, it's cheaper than actually the urine test strip, so there's also that. The second, or perhaps the more major aspect, is something that I also mentioned before, the fact that there are sulfhydrils also present in the urine that aren't present in the sweat. So this false positive, effect on the ketone levels measured is very, 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 or almost eliminated when you are using the keto patch. That's another reason why somebody would use a keto patch instead of a urine-based test strip.
So the fact that it's more accurate and mm-hmm. also more comforting to patients. Mm-hmm. Is this the first sweat test available for diabetes?
Yes, at the moment, or specifically for testing ketone levels, I can definitely say this is the first this is the first diagnostic available that utilizes sweat as its body fluid.
Interesting. So there's been no prior research utilizing this keto patch?
Nope.
similar idea?
Nope.
Interesting. So is there, as you were saying, there's a financial difference in the manufacturing cost of both tests.
Mm-hmm.
Is this significant enough that it would be an incentive for people to resort to the keto patch over urine tests?
I wouldn't say specifically significant between urine tests and the keto patch, but it's definitely a significant difference between the keto patch itself and blood ketone meters, because those cost I'd say upwards of at least $50, whereas a single keto patch would be 50 cents, and I guess a package of 8 would perhaps be $4, and mm-hmm. and like that comparison, especially considering the comfort level as well versus in blood meter versus a keto patch, that's perhaps what would make the keto patch a better alternative, especially for a younger demographic.
So, throughout the course of your study, what were some challenges you have faced in your research? So, like you were saying, there was a lot of side reactions that were going mm-hmm. on that were inhibiting the accuracy of your mm-hmm. results. So, how have you learned from these and overcome these obstacles to mm-hmm. improve your test and research in general?
All right. So, I'll name my one, the biggest challenge that I faced when I was, like, actually coming up with the idea of a patch, and that was, how do I, like, prevent the chemicals in the patch itself, the chemicals that have to be there, how do I prevent these chemicals from coming in contact with the skin? So those chemicals definitely shouldn't be coming into contact with the skin, especially if the keto patch is to be used multiple times, especially sometimes in the same area. So in that case, my biggest obstacle was figuring out a barrier that would let ketone molecules from the sweat through, but not let the actual chemicals of the patch out of the patch onto like the skin. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I overcame it by actually accident. That's how a lot of things happen.
The best things happen by accident.
Best things happen by accident. So what I actually found was a really common material that was in the laboratory, and actually the other students using the same laboratory were using like many quantities of this substance, and the substance was hydrophobic glass wool. So they showed me how, hey, this is what we use as a barrier for our experiments involving they were doing things like involving fluid dynamics and stuff like that. And they were like, this is what we use when we come across a problem about filtration. And this is based on the molecular weight of the substances that we're using. Since you seem to have the same issue, first you might want to look at the chemicals that you're using. And if stuff works out ideally, try this out.
So what exactly is hydrophobic glass wool?
So hydrophobic glass wool is basically glass wool itself is something that when you see underneath the microscope, it seems really smooth, very long, smooth fibers, because it's made from woven glass. And when it's hydrophobized, it means it's basically waterproofed. So that makes, for our purposes, it makes it a better barrier between the sweat of the body and the chemicals inside the patch.
So it reduces the diffusion mm-hmm. across the barrier.
Pretty much. And it makes it much more specific as well, because it only allows the ketones through one way, because the molecular weight of the ketones is much smaller than that of the sodium nitroprusside.
So when and how long has it taken you to do this research?
So I started my research at the beginning of my junior year, so it's been about a year and a half since then. And currently what I'm looking into, rather than doing more practical research, is looking for more research on exactly how I can make the transition from in vitro to in vivo studies.
What species for testing are you looking at?
At the moment, I would definitely begin with beginning my studies on humans itself, because at the moment, there are no really known risks that are present in this keto patch. So progressing simply to patients themselves isn't a very big transition, because there are no risks that really have to be excessively accommodated for, I guess.
And you can directly use human skin as mm-hmm. opposed to other species where fur and other factors mm-hmm. might be.
Especially because different. In other species, diabetes works differently, of course,
So you said you've been doing research since seventh grade. So do you mm-hmm. remember your first project?
My first project was very, very basic. It was the effect of different liquids, actually, on plant growth. And I think that was the very first time I'd done science fair. So it was like the introduction to many, many greater years to come. Yeah, that was a very, very basic project.
Well, I think you have to start somewhere in order to grow from there.
That's true.
So what liquids did you test on plants?
I distinctly remember using orange juice, milk, water, and a baking soda solution.
Did the plants like orange juice?
They really like baking soda.
Baking soda, okay.
I don't know why.
So what motivates you to do research, and why do you still do it after all these years?
So my seventh grade project was really lame, but I remember my science teacher actually giving us more feedback on it. And besides our school science fair, we were also allowed to compete in other science fairs as well. And I think it was at the regionals level for another science fair in our region, which is called the Lehigh Valley Science and Engineering Fair. That was where I saw the projects of older students. And it was really inspiring to me as a younger student that, hey, with the background knowledge I can accrue one day, it's possible for me to answer questions like these, to do research like this, and, you know, to be so knowledgeable about these subjects. That's what really motivated me to continue research and really do it about what really interested me.
So how do you suggest that younger students get involved in science like you did? Do you think they should visit science fairs and see other people's projects?
Well, science is itself very, very, very broad. So I would highly recommend that for younger students who seem interested in science, the perhaps the most important thing they can do is simply look for opportunities, yes, to explore science, how it is outside the classroom, whether it's visiting science fairs, science museums, or perhaps even talks by other scientists.
Was there a turning point in this study where you realized that this project had potential or that made you look in another direction?
I definitely realized the project had potential at my eureka moment, I'd call it. It was when after trying to figure out how the patch would work, the patch actually worked in its primary stages. And I was like, oh, it turned from yellow to pink. It actually happened.
Was that like a big relief that it finally
worked?
It was
a very big relief because I wasn't sure at all how the concentrations of ketones in the artificial liquid I'd made would pass through or work with the components inside the keto patch. So when it showed me the results that I wanted, it was really enlightening. And I was like, okay, fine. Maybe the rest will work out too.
Was there ever a moment where you thought that this project couldn't work and you wanted to stop or change direction entirely into a new field after successive errors or mm-hmm. or just obstacles along the way?
It definitely happened in the very beginning stages where I had the issues of specifically making this test, but it had to be something viable, something that would be safe for humans, and same thing that would be, you know, worth testing for. Why make an alternative test when it had no real advantage? So while doing research, thankfully, I was able to find enough research to support the fact that this alternative testing is necessary. And
found literary backing for your claims.
Exactly. And after that, it was really just a lot of trial and error that led me to believe, okay, it's slowly I'm crossing up possibilities that won't work, but I will. I'm narrowing down the avenues of basically experimentation. So I do believe that I can get somewhere. And eventually I did.
So do you plan to develop this idea further, as we were saying before, to mm-hmm. A new condition or expand within diabetes specifically? Mm-hmm.
So currently my research is kind of at a stagnant point because I'm mostly doing research and not much practical experimentation. At the moment, I'm looking to expand my own experiences and my own knowledge on how I can better optimize this innovation for human use. I'm looking for experiences of my own first. So perhaps I'd be experimenting in a different field for a while and then coming back to this innovation and perhaps making it better then.
So you're a senior right now. Mm-hmm. What are your plans for college next year?
So thankfully, I got into college. That was a real issue. But yes.
But now you're set. Where are you going?
I'm going to Johns Hopkins. I'll be in the class of 2023. And I'm majoring in biomedical engineering. So that's definitely a field which is high in research, and it definitely interacts with a lot of research, especially in the medical fields.
And do you think that you will continue this avenue of research there, or probably hopefully try something new?
I definitely plan on trying something new first, and then coming back to this, coming back to my own research eventually, once I have the skills, I guess, the greater skills and more knowledge needed to be more, to optimize this CUDA badge.
So do you have any last advice for other young scientists trying to follow in your footsteps or just get involved in science and figure out if they even want to participate in scientific research?
Well, there's this one thing that my parents always told me, and it's you never know if you like it until you try it. So sometimes it takes more than one or two tries. Sometimes it takes 3, 4, 6. That was me.
To get past the point of feeding plants orange juice.
Yes, that's definitely true. But yes, it definitely takes a long time. And it always helps to have somebody to guide you, whether it be your parents, your teachers, or perhaps even older students, to show you an example or to show you
just what a mentor to lead you along the way.
To show you, yeah, what you can do and what other people like you are capable of. And that sometimes that kind of inspiration is very, very helpful for younger students who think science is just what they're reading in their textbooks.
Thank you, Nehali, for being with us today. It's really been interesting hearing about your work, and it's inspiring. It is truly due to studies like yours that medical technology is advancing so rapidly. Thank you for tuning in with us today on WDIY's Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thank you again to Seamus McGrogan, and especially thank you, Nehali, from Parkland High School, for being with us today. It was really nice to talk to you, Nehali. I'm Ria Malhotra, and this is WDIY 88.1 FM.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. We are Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm John Pierce, your host for this evening, and we have a very special program coming up. Neil Heaver is our Director of Operations, and he's doing our engineering for us. Today we're highlighting some exciting activities that young folks are doing, and I'm talking about high schoolers. We're going to spend a half hour talking about some students and a faculty advisor from Liberty High School. We have two clubs that we want to talk about today. We have Cancer Crushers Relay for Life, and the other one is called Humans of Liberty, and also the Photography Club. My guest this evening, Adam Wright's social studies teacher. For how many years at Liberty?
This is 16.
Okay. And we said off the air, it's about half of a career.
Yeah, typically, right? 35 years. Yeah. Goes fast.
It goes when it's going quickly, that means you're having a good time.
Good.
And seniors Sam Rice and Emily Vesperus. Sam and Emily, welcome to WDIY.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, both of you originally from Bethlehem?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
What schools did you attend?
I went to Calypso Elementary and then Nichman Middle School, and I'm now at Liberty High School.
Mm-hmm. I went to Hanover Elementary and then Nichman Middle School, and now at Liberty.
So we have exactly the same schools, the two of you?
No, we went to different elementary schools.
Different elementary. And now Liberty High School seniors. Now, you are very involved in this club that's called Cancer Crushers Relay for Life. Explain to our listeners a little bit what that club does.
So we're a cancer research fundraising club, and we have different fundraisers throughout the year in our school and the community, just to raise different money to go to the American Cancer Society.
So at the end of the year, our biggest event is Relay for Life. This year, it is June 1st at Dimmick Park, and This year, it's only 12 hours from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
What do you mean only?
It usually is 24.
Holy smokes. That you run or?
No, there's different events throughout the day that, like different activities that we can do. And we stay up all night and we have like different like s'more sessions. We have a fire, different like dance parties.
Do you have a pizza party?
No, we don't.
Oh, you don't? I thought that's what they did nowadays. Adam, if you want to get the young folks involved, throw a pizza party.
You have to give them pizza.
Yeah. Good for you all. So you have other activities. Tell me a little bit more about the different kinds of activities that you do on that particular day.
I know a lot of the kids involved like to do 2 a.m. dodgeball. So we go into the field behind us and we play dodgeball in the dark.
There's also a dance party. That's like 3 a.m. usually.
Yeah.
All right. And you've also been walking for part of the time?
Yeah.
How many hours would you be walking that day?
It varies. You don't have to walk the entire time. There's different themed laps that we do, and so you can pick and choose which laps you want to walk.
Okay. And all this is for cancer research?
With the American Cancer Society.
Do you know how much money you wind up raising typically?
Last year, our club alone at Liberty raised about $7,000.
Terrific. And is there a special reason that the two of you are interested in research for cancer? Is cancer a part of your family history?
Yeah, my grandfather passed away from leukemia about a year and a half ago, and my grandmother is a breast cancer survivor.
My grandmother is also a breast cancer survivor, and my grandfather passed away this summer from cancer.
Just amazing how pervasive cancer is. And I think we should really be calling it cancers because they're just all over the body, right? Different kinds of cancer. And I remember the days when, now this was before you all were born, when you would not want to pronounce the word cancer. If it was in your family, it was looked upon as a disgrace. And to us, that seems so strange today because it's out there and hooray, you know, it's good for it to be out there.
Yeah, my mom passed away a year ago from cancer, and I think it's incredible the research they've done and the things they're coming up with to combat it, you know, with the help of all these different types of clubs and things. I mean, my mom had immunotherapy, proton therapy, and all these things that, you know, probably prolonged her life by 3 or 4 years that in the past it would not have.
Right. My mother also died of breast cancer. She had it way back 1960 or so. She died in 1988. So it was in remission all those years, and then it came back at the end. So it's such a huge topic, cancer crushers. Sam, go for it.
We have, some of the different fundraisers we do throughout the year, we have wish bracelets, which are little beaded bracelets that we tie on our wrists, and you make a wish when you tie it on, and when it falls off, the saying is that your wish will come true. And we also have different T-shirts that we do for a pink out each year in October. We also have hope bracelets, which are little pink bracelets with a little breast cancer ribbon on them.
We also do dine and donates. So people will go show a flyer, and then we get a percentage of the profit.
They go to a restaurant?
Yeah.
Is it one particular restaurant or several?
Several, usually throughout
the year.
We have
different ones throughout the year.
And it'll be listed on the sheet, and you just show that at the restaurant?
Yes.
Great idea, too, for a fundraiser. What else do we have, Emily?
So a lot of us joined because we know a lot of the kids at Liberty are affected by cancer, and it's a big problem in our society. And we both joined as sophomores as members, and then eventually we became leaders the following year.
How often does the club meet?
About once a month or once every other month.
Mm-hmm. And how many students would you say usually participate in a meeting?
Meetings are hard because there's so many other activities that kids are involved in as well. But at our relay event at the end of the year, we have between 50 and 75 kids that show up.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yes, impressive.
I think Sam said about how you know, the kids are involved in so much. There's so much, so many things going on at Liberty High School that, you know, are positive, and the kids spread themselves thin with all the activities they have. I mean, between sports and the arts and all these different clubs, there's a lot of good stuff going on there.
We're still using the term spread yourself too thin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that goes way back to my days, and we're talking the 1950s when I was in high school. That, for you folks, that's the Middle Ages. let's talk to you a little bit just personally. You're seniors now. So, Emily, what are you going to be doing a year from now?
I will be studying cognitive and behavioral neuroscience at Villanova University.
Terrific. Have you already been accepted?
Yes.
So you know you're going there.
Yeah.
All right. First time living away from home?
Yeah.
All right. But not that far.
No. Right. Only like an hour.
Yeah. That's comforting to your parents.
Yeah.
You probably don't care. But you have to be gentle with your parents.
Yeah.
At this time of life. And Sam, how about you?
I'll be at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg studying creative writing and communications.
All right. So interesting futures for both of you coming up too. And I just hope that in the future you are not touched by this really bad scourge, which is called cancer. But you're making your fellow classmates and students at Liberty very much aware that we have to be doing something. And it's all over the place with the athletes, too. Huh?
Yeah.
They'll don certain uniforms, a different uniform sometimes, to bring awareness to cancers.
It affects everybody. You know, I think the statistics are one out of every four people, you know, are affected by or have it. So I think everyone knows somebody, close family, that has...
That sounds like mental illness to me.
Yeah.
It's about one out of four people will get some form of it. And if you don't have it yourself, you know someone. There's someone in the family or a close friend, and the same with cancer. I thank you for coming and sharing this story about cancer, the cancer crushers, you call it. I love that term. Is that a long-term term at Liberty, or did you all come up with that?
It's been the club name for about 5 years now.
All right. Yeah, Cancer Crushers, and you talk about the Relay for Life. Seniors Sam Rice and Emily Vispras are just about ready to say goodbye to Liberty High School. Adam, it's not going to be the same without them.
No, it won't. There's always a new crew coming in, though, that'll fill their shoes. These, you know, Bethlehem is the school district has adopted this, the saying "built by Bethlehem," and these kids are obviously have been built by Bethlehem, and they've done a good job.
Built by Bethlehem, I like it. Yes, and at Liberty, you're the Hurricane.
We are.
Do you know why William Allen High School is called the Canaries?
I do. Girls?
No. I don't know.
So I believe it dates back to when Bethlehem, it wasn't Liberty, it was Bethlehem, I believe, right?
Correct.
Bethlehem played Allentown in football.
That was the big rivalry.
That was the big rivalry, and Bethlehem always used to win, I think. And then the one time Allentown won, and it said Allentown flew through the hurricane, I believe. And the canary is the only bird that can fly through a hurricane.
That's the reason. All right. We learned something today, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you, both of you, Sam and Emily, in your future. And thanks for coming by and talking to us about Cancer Crushers and the Relay for Life.
Best wishes.
Thank you.
Folks, it's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll be talking about something called Humans of Liberty. You don't know what that is. You're going to be amazed by it. Stay with us.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Another really impressive club at Liberty High School is called Humans of Liberty. I also want to throw in here the photography club, because student Alana Bezos participates in the Humans of Liberty. And also, how did it come about, Alana, that the photography sneaked in there?
So I had the idea to start a photography club since my sophomore year, but it took a little while to find a teacher advisor. So junior year, last year, I started up the club, and we meet once a month, so we have monthly meetings, and we kind of just collaborate and share ideas. Each meeting has a theme. So just yesterday, we met a few of us at the Liberty track meet, and so we took pictures there, and we'll look at those at our next meeting. We have a hike scheduled. When the weather gets nice, we try and get outside and take pictures. So that's what we're up to now.
All right. Now, you're all using your smartphones for the pictures, I hope.
Also cameras. Most of us have cameras, but for those of us that don't, either we lend our cameras or they use their phones. They've gotten good cameras.
I said that kind of as a joke, thinking, oh, you know, photography club, we're not going to go near a smartphone, please. Good for you for being open-minded about it. So photography is a passion of yours.
Yep.
You are a senior.
I am.
At Liberty. So, Adam, we're also saying goodbye to Alana in just a few weeks, really.
Yeah, it's end of the year's flying up here.
Listen, it's coming to a close quickly. And Alana, you are also Bethlehem gal.
I am,
yeah. You sure you weren't born on a Greek island?
No.
But you have background there.
I do.
You've been there.
Mm-hmm.
What's the island?
Limnos.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I just think of Greece. I think blue and white.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's the sky, the sea, and that great architecture over there. So let's talk about the club called Humans of Liberty. Adam, you had, I'd like to go to the genesis of this. How did you get the idea to come up with this club?
So ultimately, my wife and I were sitting around and talking. I was telling her a story about one of my students. I had a kid named, 2 years ago, I had a kid named Peanut. His nickname was Peanut. And he was this kid who would come in second block. He would always be late. But he was the funniest, nicest kid in the world. And you know, you'd sit there and think, why is this kid late all the time? And it wasn't until, you know, a couple weeks in that you realized his mom was working 18 hours a day, and he was taking his little brother to, you know, walking his little brother to elementary school before he'd get to school, and that's why he was kind of late. And you just realize that all these kids, and everyone at Liberty has some type of story that you know, if everyone knew a little bit more about each other, that, you know, there'd be more understanding and we wouldn't be such a divisive society, I guess. I mean,
yes.
And that happens all over, especially in our country now, how divisive we are, that if everyone just took a moment and kind of, you know, learned about somebody else and what they've gone through, that they'd be a little more understanding and everyone would get along a little bit better.
Well, terrific idea. But now what happened was I went to the website for Liberty High School and found, in fact, let's tell our listeners if they want to look in, it's a pretty long website. They could just put in Liberty High School
Bethlehem, it will come up. Yeah.
And then go to where you find these pictures of students and staff and faculty.
So ultimately, it's an Instagram account. It's on Instagram, and we have the Liberty website linked up to it. But it's on Twitter, and the Bethlehem Area School District does a great job of putting it on their Facebook page as well. So there's a bunch of different outlets, but if you go to Humans of Liberty on Instagram or on Twitter, it will come up. And you know, just different stories of, like you said, students who are there, alumni, teachers, and it just gives, you know, normally their background and something that, you know, has affected their life or has made them who they are. We all have a story, and it just gives everyone a platform to kind of tell their story.
Aren't most people's stories just not very interesting?
I think that everyone's got something that, you know, is very interesting. For example, there's one student who we did a story on that was in an orphanage in Latvia until he was 15, and he was about to be kicked out in the street, and an American couple came and adopted him, and he ended up at Liberty. I know Mr. Frank, who is one of the band directors at school, we did one on him, and no one realized that he spent, I don't know if it was 4 or 8 years in the Marines. And he said kids were coming up to him asking about his time in the Marines, and he was in the Marine band and all that. So we have a bunch of, like I said, a lot of, you know, there's some bad press that comes out about Liberty, but most, a lot of good things going on, and I think that gets overlooked with some stuff, but a lot of great people at Liberty High School, kids, faculty, staff.
Right, and you're right to highlight these stories. Everyone has a story, and my point is that our stories are not as uninteresting as we might think they are. I don't have any kind of an extraordinary life, but I've been through some things that might be interesting to some folks. And especially when a student like Alana gets to know someone like the band director, the background, and where that person. Do you yourself have a picture on the page?
I do not.
Is it out of humility?
It is. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
All those of you in this room right now who think that Mr. Reitz is basically humble, raise your hand. None of the three.
They don't know me that well.
That's why you need your picture up there. Mm-hmm. So what do we see, Alana, when we look at that at the web page and we see these pictures?
So basically, if you scroll through the page, you'll see a bunch of portraits. And we're trying to get them to be a little more creative. So how it works is Mr. Reitz will email me the name of a student, the next student that he wants to feature, whether it's somebody that is in one of his classes or somebody that he's seen through the halls. So he'll reach out to me, and then I connect that student via email with one of the photography club members. So I introduce the two over email, and I ask the person whose picture is being taken to bring a prop or wear a t-shirt, or something that goes with their post. So we had one student move to California, so she wore a shirt that said East Coast to West Coast. One was about a soccer player, so he wore his jersey. I know another girl spoke about her mom and her relationship with her mother, so she held up a photograph of the two. So just trying to get the post more interesting.
And you take many of the pictures that are on
the
page.
I do, yep.
So that's your. Do you have others in the photography club who also take pictures?
Yep. So I reached out to Mr. Reitz shortly after I started the club up, asking if he needed any help. I'm a huge fan of Brandon Stanton's Humans of New York. And he's a photojournalist who started Humans of New York as an Instagram account also. And I've followed those posts and read those stories. I even have the hardcover book. I just find them so interesting. So when I heard that we were having one at Liberty, I got really interested and wanted to be involved.
For a minute there, I thought you were the one who brought the idea, since you were already looking at New York.
Nope, it was Mr. Reitz.
All right.
Yeah.
So you also were a fan of what was happening in New York?
Yeah, and like I said, everyone, there's so many interesting stories at Liberty. So it started very generically, I think. We pulled the kid from the football team who was on the football team in the band, and I was asking the yearbook photographer to come take pictures, and again, pulling them too thin. And Alana reached out to me and said that, you know, she started the photography club and would be interested in collaborating a little bit. And she has basically taken from the picture side. And also finding people, too. As you mentioned, kids in my class, I get other teachers recommending kids a lot of, from the ESOL program, so kids who are coming in and English is their second language. And they've brought a bunch of people to me as well, you know, kids that they know who are interesting and have a story.
And if we go to the webpage on the Liberty High School webpage and find this Humans of Liberty, we'll see three pictures in a row, and then we scroll down, and it's a total of how many pictures now?
I think there's 75 posts as of this week.
Okay.
We try and get one out each week.
And I asked, there's so many pictures. I was amazed that there would be 75 pictures here, but then Adam told me, oh, we never eliminate any. So this is going to be forever.
It's a running total, and my hope is next year or two to make it into a book that we can put in the main office and put at the Ed Center, you know, so people can see all these stories.
Great idea. Right. And so, Alana, you also believe that people have interesting stories to tell, even though they may not think they do.
I do, yeah.
Is your picture there?
Yes, my picture actually is there.
Okay, you're one of the 75.
Yep.
And how about our other two students here? No?
No, not as of now, anyway.
Not yet. Soon to be alumni, so maybe you'll get into that category of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just am so impressed with this project that when I saw it at home, I went to my wife and said, you just have to come and look at this. And she also was very impressed. What a great idea. I think we ought to spread the word to other schools. Do you do any of that? Do you go to conferences where you talk about?
We have not. We have not. It's just been a Liberty thing. That's
yeah. All right. Yeah. I'd love to see it at not only high schools, but also you could do this for middle schools, maybe elementary. I hadn't thought about that really. Colleges would be a super kind of thing to do.
Absolutely.
Alana, you know what I'm most impressed with? The fact that you are communicating via email.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do not do social media since I'm an old guy. And I thought that young folks thought that email was the 20th century.
Well, it's difficult at times when some students don't check their email, I'll have to admit. But when you go to such a large high school, it's the easiest way, especially if you've never met the person prior to taking their picture. It's the easiest way to connect people.
The easiest way is email and not social media.
Mm-hmm.
All the students have a school district account. So all the kids have a Liberty High School or Bethel Mary School District email, which makes it very easy that they and most of the information that they get about school events and things goes through that. So 95% of them check their school email consistently. So I think that works out well in that. And basically all you have to do is type their name into the to area and their name pops up. So it's not difficult for them to find either.
Yeah, great technology.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Alana, what's in the future for you now? What do you think a year from now, on which island will you be basking in the sun in Greece?
I am not sure. I'm not sure where I'm going to school yet. I'm still choosing. I have until May 1st to make my decision, so we'll see.
Do you have any colleges on your short list you'd tell us about?
As of now, it's between the University of Pittsburgh, Ithaca College, and Millersville University.
Okay.
So.
Very good. And what do you think you want to study? Do you have an idea about that at this point?
I'm looking into environmental science programs and maybe even environmental engineering with a focus in sustainability. Yeah.
And you will continue your interest in photography, I imagine.
For sure.
As a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're coming to the end of our time here with folks from Liberty High School. Some really exciting things are going on. We talked about Cancer Crushers and Relay for Life with Sam Rice and Emily Vispris. And we also talked about Humans of Liberty, their program of basically people telling their stories and showing pictures of them with teacher Adam Reitz, who teaches social studies at Liberty, and with senior Alana Bezis. Thanks so much, all of you, for coming by to visit with us here on WDIY. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in. Thanks to Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations, for our engineering this evening. I'm John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.